We still need to recognize that it's still an uphill and long-term battle for us to continue our fight for free election and democracy.
Hong Kong protesters met with tear gas. It's Monday, December 2nd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, climate change in focus for many nations this week. Challenges to traditional regional security. A new candidate emerges for U.S. president. Rebuilding from tragedy. World AIDS Day. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Hong Kong police used tear gas to disperse thousands of pro-democracy activists gathered in the Sim Sha Tsui shopping district late Sunday afternoon. The demonstrators had come to protest against what they see as China's creeping interference in Hong Kong since the territory was returned to Beijing by Britain in 1997. Earlier Sunday, some demonstrators marched to the American consulate to thank the United States for newly signed bipartisan legislation supporting the Hong Kong pro-democracy activists. Some activists carried banners reading, "President Trump, please liberate Hong Kong," and "Let's make Hong Kong great again." Early Sunday, about 200 protesters marched from Edinburgh Square to government buildings to protest against police using tear gas. Protesters also gathered near the Polytechnic University in the afternoon, the site of the last fierce clashes with police 2 weeks ago, and marched to the Hong Kong Coliseum. The marches came 1 week after pro-democracy candidates won a landslide victory in district-level elections. China accused the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights of emboldening radical violence in Hong Kong by suggesting the city's leader conduct an investigation into reports of excessive use of force by police. It's something many protesters, including pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong, would like to see happen.
After the high turnout and a remarkable achievement in the district council election, police brutality still exists, and we are calling the government to set up the investigation commission on police brutality. And with more than 100,000 people, I believe, will take to the street today, which proves the solidarity. No matter reform inside the district council or protest on street, I think now after U.S. president signed on the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act and how the victory in the district council, we still need to recognize that it's still an uphill and long-term battle for us to continue our fight for free election and democracy.
With many demonstrators marching toward the American consulate on Sunday, many of Hong Kong's pro-democracy activists want city leader Carrie Lam to step down, but she refuses. She has also refused to open an independent investigation into alleged police brutality. Pro-democracy protesters renewed pressure on the Hong Kong government Sunday, demanding an investigation into reports of excessive use of force by police. The protesters have been venting their frustrations for 6 months, and demonstrations have become increasingly violent. The mood in Hong Kong, however, seemed to have changed recently following local elections that gave a resounding win to pro-democracy activists. Hong Kong police have arrested 5,890 people since the protests began in June. These are among some of the top Asia headlines that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. As North Korea's deadline approaches, South pushes U.S. for progress. Hong Kong pro-democracy rally cut short by police tear gas. Samoa measles cases, deaths more than double in a week. Freed Taliban prisoner believes SEAL teams attempted rescues. U.S. sending ships to South China Sea to teach Beijing not to fight it. Read and watch more on VOA Asia Facebook and Twitter. Plus, see these stories at the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Environment ministers and experts from nearly 200 countries meet in Madrid later today for annual United Nations climate talks. presided by Chile and hosted by Spain, the so-called COP25 follows a raft of alarming studies and real-life evidence of climate change's potentially catastrophic fallout. From the Spanish capital, Lisa Bryant reports for VOA, this might be the last year the United States is part of the talks.
Rising seas, shrinking ice caps, deadly floods, fires, and droughts. These aren't just future nightmares, but today's reality in many parts of our fast-warming world. More grim news this past week. The UN says greenhouse gases reached new records last year, despite global promises to slash them. Even if governments meet their current pledges, emissions may soar in the decades ahead to triple the 1.5 degree limit scientists say is crucial to avoid the most extreme effects.
The thing is that today the science is really clear. We have a maximum 10 years to act to fight global warming, and all scientists say that we are in a climate and biodiversity crisis.
This two-week conference sets the stage for 2020, the next five-year deadline for countries to update their emissions-cutting targets. Some key goals here: creating effective rules for a global carbon market, allowing countries to trade emissions reductions with each other, and finalizing financing for poorer countries to respond to climate change.
I think that we have enormous warning signs and enormous signs of progress at the same time, and enormous opportunity all at the same time.
One big negative for those here at the conference: one of the biggest greenhouse gas emitters, the United States, is scheduled to pull out of the Paris Climate Pact next November.
They're still at the table this year, but with much less leverage than would have otherwise been the case.
Others, like China and India, continue to rely on polluting industries, even as they adopt renewable energy. But climate action is going local. Cities and regions are coming up with green solutions. People are calling on their governments to do more.
The good news is that there is raising awareness, especially from young generations, on the fact that we can act and we have all the solutions to act.
The European Union is proposing a so-called Green Deal to make the region carbon neutral by 2050. Dozens of countries elsewhere have also pledged to increase their emissions-cutting goals. WRI's David Waskow points to another positive. The cooperation between Spain and Chile in organizing this conference, showing the kind of can-do spirit countries might need to reach ambitious climate change solutions going forward. For VOA News, Lisa Bryant, Madrid.
Happening now in Asia news, an Australian teacher held captive with an American colleague by the Taliban for more than 3 years believes U.S. Special Forces tried and failed 6 times to free them. Timothy Weeks was released last month in a prisoner swap with Kevin King, ending an ordeal that began with their abduction in 2016. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you've joined us for the beginning of another week on VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump is heading to London this week to attend the North Atlantic Treaty Organization leaders' meeting. Forged at the start of the Cold War, NATO is celebrating its 70th anniversary, and the summit is designed to affirm the strength of the alliance. But European leaders are bracing for Trump ahead of the meeting as they continue to question Washington's commitment to NATO. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Suara has this report from London.
Fighting continues in northeastern Syria following Turkey's invasion of Kurdish-held territory. President Donald Trump ordered American forces to leave in October without consulting NATO allies.
It's exactly in the wake of that decision that you had President Macron say what he said about the alliance being brain dead, and referencing the lack of American leadership in the sense of leading in a community and not just going out on your own.
Meanwhile, a simmering war between Russia and Ukraine has become the backdrop of Trump's impeachment. The two conflicts in Europe's eastern and southern flank further complicate Washington's already strained relations with other NATO members. Leaders this side of the Atlantic are bracing for Donald Trump, whom they will meet at the NATO summit just outside of London this week. Trump no longer publicly says that NATO is obsolete and wants to leave it, but continues to slam member countries for not meeting NATO's 2% GDP defense spending target. American officials have reassured European leaders of Washington's continued commitment, as shown by military reinforcement in NATO's eastern flank. But anxiety persists that under Trump, the U.S. is neglecting the alliance.
Some of them hoping that Trump will be out of office, you know, in a year's time. But the real fear is that Trump wins a second term.
Across Europe, responses differ. Paris is touting strategic autonomy, that Europe should take care of their own security. Warsaw is promoting a strategic embrace, developing close bilateral relationship with Trump to guarantee its own security.
And then you have Germany in the middle, which is, I think, a little bit divided between sort of Atlanticists on the one hand, who do believe in NATO and believe that NATO continues to be how the security of Europe should be guaranteed. And then on the other hand, post-Atlanticists, who are sort of more on the French side of this argument. Europeans are very much arguing about that.
Among Europeans' goals this week, simply avoiding a Trump flare-up, like those that have happened in past meetings.
You can talk about all the things that they've done, and very smartly suggest that President Trump has generated the kind of pressure to make those things happen. So they can actually praise President Trump, even though this is very hard for them to do because of the personality.
Just days before the summit, NATO announced it had agreed to redistribute costs and reduce Washington's contribution to its relatively small central budget, a move aimed at placating Trump. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, London.
Coming up, a new wrinkle in U.S. presidential politics. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news from VOA Asia, the number of suspected cases of measles on the Pacific island of Samoa has more than doubled over the past week to more than 3,500. Deaths related to the outbreak rose to 48 from 20 a week ago. Samoa has become vulnerable to measles outbreaks as the number of people becoming immunized has declined. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for this and much more. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the crowded field of U.S. Democratic presidential hopefuls has added a new name, with former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg officially joining the race. VOA's Ardita Dunalari reports the 77-year-old billionaire investor and philanthropist has name recognition and millions of dollars of his own fortune for campaign spending. But polls show the political moderate who once ran as a Republican faces skepticism among some Democrats.
Michael Bloomberg is campaigning on policies that he says will help the middle class and restore fairness to the American economy.
And the struggling middle class will get their fair share. And jobs that just allow you to get by will become jobs that let you get ahead.
The billionaire is running at a time when many Democrats are decrying income inequality in America and bristle at the ultra-wealthy. Bloomberg is counting on his resume to win over voters, his tenure as a successful media and technology mogul, and as the mayor who revitalized New York City after the September 11 attacks.
What Michael Bloomberg inherited was literally a disaster zone in Lower Manhattan, and he was able to rebuild that city in a significant way and rebuild that city through a recession.
As mayor, Bloomberg instituted a law enforcement policy known as Stop and Frisk, which disproportionately subjected African Americans to random police checks. Bloomberg recently apologized for the policy, saying he did not fully understand how it impacted minorities, which are viewed as crucial constituencies of the Democratic Party. Going forward, the world's ninth wealthiest man is expected to pour millions into advertising.
There's never been a candidate who announced for president and within days spent $37 million, and that's just the beginning.
Polls show Bloomberg now averaging around 3% support from Democrats. But with no clear frontrunner in the primary, some analysts say his money gives him influence and the perception of independence in the political arena.
It is better for a candidate to spend his own money than to raise hundreds of millions of dollars from people who want something, whether it's an ambassadorship or a provision in the law to benefit their business.
At the same time that money can be a political liability, in a party promising to reverse the growing gap between rich and poor in America.
I understand that rich people are going to have more shoes than the rest of us. They're going to have more cars than the rest of us. They're going to have more houses. But they don't get a bigger share of democracy.
Bloomberg argues he's the best candidate to beat President Trump with his political centrism and vast fortune. Will voters agree? Popularity is not easy to buy, says Hudak.
President Trump connected with voters in a very personal way. It is not clear that Michael Bloomberg has that same sort of political charisma.
For now, Bloomberg is skipping the earliest state nominating contests in February. His first major test comes on March 3rd, when 14 states will hold primary elections on what is known as Super Tuesday. Ardita Dunelari, VOA News, Washington.
This news break from VOA Asia. A huge crowd took to the streets of Hong Kong Sunday, some driven back by tear gas, to demand more democracy and an investigation into the use of force to crack down on the 6-month-long anti-government demonstrations. Thousands turned out, including parents with their young children. Visit VOA Asia on YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. This is VOA Asia. Now in VOA Asia, it's been a year since the deadliest fire in California history. The blaze destroyed 90% of the town of Paradise, killing 85 people. Much of the burned debris has been removed, and empty lots remain. Most of the fire survivors are scattered, living in other towns and cities. But a few who have moved back to Paradise dream of a day when the town is vibrant again. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has the story of one family who is trying to rebuild the town.
This is where I brought my kids home. Yeah, it's where they learned how to ride a bike.
Only a slab is left from Lori Hornback's memories of life here after hell came to Paradise a year ago and left survivors with nothing.
You lose your house, you lose your church, you lose your shopping center where you knew everybody. Your post office, your everything is just gone, and you, because nobody's there anymore. Your neighbor now lives in LA. Your other neighbor now lives in Tennessee. You know, you'll never probably ever see them again. It's more than just losing your home. It's losing the whole community.
When Hornback finds a neighbor who has returned, it's like discovering treasure.
I'm so glad you're coming back.
Hornback, her two grown children, and their families each lived in different homes in Paradise when a fire caused by electrical transmission lines burned through town.
And I ran out without any shoes, ran out without anything because things were exploding all the way around us.
Hornback didn't want to return at first, but later changed her mind, partly because her daughter Brittany Richardson wanted to come back.
This is where we were raised. This is where everything was so familiar to us. We knew where the closest store was, the closest hospital. This is where we were raised.
This is our heart.
So this is Paradise. Is where we belong.
Lori and I chose to stay because we felt like we needed to do something here. Yeah, we needed to be part of this.
This is the rebuilding process, says Lori Hornback's husband, John, who owns a construction company. He, his son-in-law, and the team are literally rebuilding with their hands. Hornback says this house received the first permits to rebuild after the fire. And work these days has become personal.
You know, I live here. This is my town. It's part of me. You know, it's in my heart, you know. I mean, you want to be part of the repair.
I'm actually very proud of the speed of the town that's recovering because we worked together. We worked as a team. Everybody did, even if strangers.
The Hornbacks bought this house in Paradise that did not burn. Under this roof, there are now 12 people, including their grown children, their families, and other relatives. Now, with much of the trees gone, Hornback has quite a view.
all these trees will come back, and it's beautiful up here, and it's just peaceful. It's going to be better, beautiful, and everybody's going to be stronger. We're resilient.
And as paradise is reborn, Hornback hopes more people will return. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Paradise, California.
When AIDS was first identified more than 40 years ago, it was considered a death sentence. Since then, it has become a chronic but treatable disease. The yearly World AIDS Day observance is a way to make people realize that AIDS is still with us, and despite advances, the epidemic is not over. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
Communities around the world observe World AIDS Day with messages about awareness and prevention. The simplest method is always to use a condom during sex. In 2004, when health ministers first designated December 1st as World AIDS Day, they realized that, unlike other diseases, the HIV virus that causes AIDS could spread globally. Paul Kawada has been an AIDS activist since the very beginning, when people with AIDS died horrible deaths. He is still in the fight at NMAC, an organization formerly known as the National Minority AIDS Council.
And I was there in the early days. I was there when we both had to fight back and act out and also bury so many people that we loved.
Dr. Anthony Fauci has also been in the fight since the beginning. Fauci has been the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease since 1984. He's been involved in the development of treatments for HIV. Treatment is now so effective that if an infected person takes one pill a day, it's impossible to pass the virus to anyone else. 7 years ago, another drug became available that prevents uninfected people from getting the disease. It's called Truvada. Fauci says ending AIDS could be simple.
If you did those two things, treatment as prevention for those who are infected, pre-exposure prophylaxis for those who are at risk, if you implemented that to its fullest, theoretically you could end the epidemic just like that.
AIDS-related deaths are now down by more than 55% since the peak, but it's still with us. Kawada says gaps in treatment are the main reason.
We have to understand that HIV sits at the intersection of so much discrimination and stigma. First of all, it impacts predominantly people of color. Number two, it impacts predominantly gay men. Number three, it impacts predominantly poor people.
The majority of people with HIV in the U.S. are poor. The majority of people with HIV outside the U.S. live in low and middle-income countries. Teenagers everywhere are at risk. They have little access to testing, health care, and counseling. And that's why Fauci says we need something else besides medication.
We're not going to eliminate HIV without a vaccine.
Fauci says the work on vaccines is promising. But right now, the best tools are still getting people tested, getting those who are positive on therapy, and getting those at risk of becoming infected on therapeutics, and treating HIV as a disease, not as a political or moral or social issue. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find our program online, if you haven't already, on iTunes and SoundCloud. There you can stream our show, or you can download it as a podcast and take VOA Asia with you throughout the day. You can also visit our website, voanews.com. There we have a program page where you can also stream our show and download it if you like. See us on YouTube, Instagram, and VOA Asia Twitter. And, of course, we're on Facebook. That name is VOA Asia. Let us hear from you. You can send us an email at voaasia@voanews.com. And we'd like to thank everyone listening the, quote, traditional way on the radio. Radioactive at Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore carries our program. We say hello to everyone there today. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Kelvin Fowler, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, interns Hyong, Afra, and Candace. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a nice day.